Welcome to Conversations. I'm Bill Kristol, joined today by my friend and teacher, Harvey Mansfield, professor of government at Harvard.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you. And our topic today is Montesquieu, someone you've been doing some work on recently and extremely influential on the American founders, maybe slightly neglected, I would say, by students of political philosophy, but we can correct that today.
Yes, right? Do our best.
So Montesquieu, his real name, his full name, I guess, is... Charles Louis de Secondat, Baron de la Brède et de Montesquieu, but always known as Montesquieu.
Yes.
For some reason.
Right.
Lived 1689 to 1755, and maybe that's enough biographical information.
Yes.
Well, his major works, I guess.
Wrote three works, three major works. And one is the Persian Letters, a kind of epistolary novel.
Right.
Then a shorter work on the greatness and decline of the Romans. And then his great work, The Spirit of the Laws, de l'Esprit des Lois, The Spirit of the Laws. So you can try to work out that title maybe a little bit later. But that's the book which had the great influence on the founders.
Right, 1748, I think.
And, 1748, yeah.
So the middle of the 18th century. And quoted, I think, several times in the Federalist, quoted directly in the Federalist, and he himself cited as the celebrated Montesquieu, I remember
that's
that.
That's right.
From the Federalist. So let's talk, begin with that. Why celebrate? Why was the Federalist so interested in Montesquieu?
Celebrated and at the same time called an oracle.
Yeah.
Oracles are enigmatic, and that certainly applies to Montesquieu. He's not easy to understand. This book, The Spirit of the Laws, is very long and very complicated, and it treats, it doesn't treat anything thematically, really. And so everything gets treated in different places, very much scattered. And one of the passages that I'm going to talk about later is really from almost at the end of this book. So very complicated, and he was cited by Publius, as he said, but also by the anti-federalists. Both of them thought that Montesquieu was on their side. So the issue was, should a republic be large or should it be small? Small and homogeneous, close to the people, the popular government. This was the view of the anti-federalists, who were the opponents of the Federalists, so-called, supporters of the new Constitution. And there was an argument over the ratification of that Constitution. So the anti-Federalists supported a rather small republic view. They wanted a union, but it was to be a league of small colonies, then states, rather than a unified union that the Federalists wanted. And they cited Montesquieu because Montesquieu, in the first eight books, this is his book is divided into books of the Spirit of the Laws, discusses republics, but rather ancient than modern republics. The ancient republic, because a republican virtue began under the ancients. A republican virtue is a kind of passion. And it's a passion for patriotism to your country, but also a passion for equality, those two things together. So republican virtue is essentially something democratic. Anyway, in these first eight books, Montesquieu becomes quite critical of ancient republican virtue because, in fact, he says, they tried so hard to bring people together that they made them martial, that the main virtue of that the passion of equality led to was a warlike desire to defend yourself, and to defend yourself in such a way that you even began to attack others. So he ends his treatment of republics by making a distinction between defensive war and offensive war. And the ancient republic was so small and so unified and so proud of itself that it had a tendency to move from self-defense into aggrandizement and to become something large which it couldn't support. So Montesquieu's first treatment of republics is rather critical. And the anti-federalists fixed on this smallness of republics, not really appreciating that smallness was being criticized and that virtue, too, was being criticized. So the Federalists, I think, therefore had a better understanding of Montesquieu. But it is interesting that Montesquieu was on both sides of their
dispute. The small republic is sympathetic enough that the anti-federalists could find something in it for to defend a kind of more classical type of republicanism. But I guess separation of powers is what the Federalist cites Montesquieu for.
It is.
Anything else, perhaps.
It is.
I mean, that's just,
right. So separation of powers is a complication of power. And this is characteristic of Montesquieu. He was against any concentration of power because power had a tendency to, and now he uses this word, which is very famous in the Federalist, to encroach.
Hmm.
Yeah, the tendency of power to encroach.
I didn't know that directly comes from Montesquieu. Wow.
Yeah, uh-huh. Right. And it tends to get larger and more powerful than what it needs to be. And if you compare this to Aristotle, who also has a view of republican virtue, Aristotle speaks of the best regime in a way that Montesquieu never does. And in the best regime also has a tendency toward imperialism, because if you're better than someone else, why shouldn't you have a right to govern that other person? So when the best regime is encounters a less good regime on its borders, perhaps, it's tempted, you might say, by the principle that the best should rule, to become imperialistic. And so Montesquieu is against this. He's also against the simplicity of power, which makes you think that power after power is that men are never satisfied. They always have a restless desire for power after power. Now, that's a quotation from Thomas Hobbes, a 17th century writer. So, but Montesquieu wants to have power counteract power. So he admits the necessity of power, but then does his best to turn it against itself. Power turned against itself. I think that's in Madison's quotation his remark, which is frequently quoted in Federalist 51, ambition must be made to counteract ambition, comes directly from Montesquieu and the spirit of Montesquieu. Complication. The anti-federalists opposed the Constitution for two reasons. They said it was too concentrated, and they also said it was too complicated. That was a kind of contradiction.
Right.
Then if you don't want concentration, you need to have complication. So that's what Montesquieu brings to the American founders. And if you want a remedy against imperialism, say the Aristotelian tendency of the best regime to want to impose itself on less good regimes, he has an answer for that. And it's an answer also for the martial character of the ancient republic, and that is commerce. So he's perfectly willing to see a republic expand, but this expand in the way of commerce. So he was very interested in commercial republics like Carthage in ancient times and Venice and Holland in modern times. And this too becomes a part of America, but it's the theme is complication. It's also the theme of our Constitution. You might say that the Declaration of Independence is based on not so much Thomas Hobbes as John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
It has simple principles. Say, all men are created equal. This results in the right to consent to government, and the right to consent to government results in the right to withdraw your consent, or the right to revolt, right of revolution. So that's all that is simple, but it needs to be put into an actual working structure, so that you could say then that that the Constitution is the work of Montesquieu, and the Declaration the work of John Locke. I think that would make some sense. Although the Constitution, the very idea of Constitution can also be traced back to Locke.
And Locke is friendly to commerce and to
sort
of separation of powers.
That's
so
right.
Some of that is Montesquieu, maybe.
Yeah.
So extending Locke's liberalism, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. So Montesquieu brings complication to America's liberalism, to America's form of government, and to its even to its society. And I think that's his great contribution. So he is justly celebrated, though somewhat by our founders, and deserves to be by us.
But maybe a little neglected, it seems to me, just from my observing courses in political philosophy, because Locke's maybe a little easier to teach.
That's right. He
you
is.
Can then skip
That's
over
right.
and get right to Rousseau and the rebellion against liberalism, and somehow Montesquieu gets a little bit neglected there, maybe.
He does. The easiest of all modern political philosophers to teach is Hobbes. So every political theorist has so to speak, at least an article, if not a book, on Hobbes. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the idea. And Locke is almost as easy. Locke's second treatise of government, is, as he says, is on the principles of political right. And see, Montesquieu never has any such thing. The spirit of the laws. So what does that mean? Now, spirit makes you think of the essence or the gist or the essential feature of a thing. And that's one way of looking at politics in terms of essences. Political science today is divided between political scientists who treat in essences, that's people like me, the theory types, and then others, the empirical ones, they call themselves, and they use this nice expression, they're data-driven.
Right.
Yeah. So they're, data is means things that are given. So we theorists are not driven by data because we're dissatisfied with what is given. We want to examine and analyze and improve on it. But people who are data-driven present themselves as not... having ideas that they pursue or which inspire them, but by being almost receptacles of facts and countable facts that that they receive and merely present to us scientifically, so they have a greater claim to scientific. So, and Montesquieu is, in his title of the book, has something of the essentialist when he uses the word spirit, but then something of the data-driven when he refers to laws. So, he's not so interested in the definition of law as in the variety of different laws, circumstances, and he describes them. His erudition is unbelievable. He's not read every philosopher, every historian, but so much in the way of early law, the development of law, both Roman law, Frankish law, China, Japan. He's looked through the whole world, and his book is. Is therefore difficult to read and as you say, to teach.
Fun to read because it's full of interesting.
That's right.
You know,
it's fun, but it's difficult.
But difficult to put together. Yeah. And doesn't have that
right.
maybe slightly fake, but nonetheless clarity that Locke pretends to have at least of deduction from principles and so
That's right.
And why does Montesquieu want to avoid presenting his political philosophy the way Locke chose to, or Hobbes, the kind of deduction from principles that must be part of his,
yeah,
must be part of his intention.
Yes, and it clearly is. Yeah, so he comes in the second wave of modern political philosophy after the 17th century ones, like Machiavelli comes first, but then Hobbes and Spinoza, Locke,
right,
the first ones. And they do have much simpler principles. They simplify, and that's to make their political science more powerful, more capable, so that you have fewer inhibitions or hesitations in reading it or in applying it. And they want to be clear and distinct. That's a phrase from Descartes. Mm-hmm. And clear and distinct enables you to be more powerful with your words. Now Montesquieu comes in the next century, and he's to some extent reacting against this first wave, which promotes simplicity and revolutionism. He and Hume, you could say, also in the 18th century, a contemporary of Montesquieu. And so he thinks that simplify leads to a glorification of power, as most obviously in Hobbes, that what you consent to is the sovereignty of an absolute sovereign, and that sovereign can become very despotic. So Montesquieu is most concerned with preventing despotism. He sees despotism arising from the desire to be too good, like Plato and like Aristotle, and also from the desire to be too powerful and simple, like especially Hobbes, also Locke. He begins his Spirit of the Laws with an analysis of the state of nature, which is the fundamental principle that Hobbes really invented and Locke accepted and followed. And he does it differently. So he thinks that in the state of nature, there's two kinds of laws, natural physical laws, which operate with necessity, and then human laws. Well, human laws are made by human beings, and that's because human beings don't operate efficiently with necessary predictable results, and so they have to make for themselves laws which counteract their waywardness and which you could say is their desire for freedom, their desire to run their own lives instead of, and the rest of nature is content with being bossed around by nature, by the necessary laws of physics. So there is a discrepancy between the laws of non-human nature and the laws of human nature. And this is more like Aristotle and less like Hobbes. Hobbes wants you to think that the simplicity of his scheme, his political scheme, makes it more scientific than it would be otherwise. So Montesquieu agrees with Plato and Aristotle that human beings are different, and that their laws are different from the laws of non-human nature, but he doesn't think that there can be one reason which unites them, or one general moving principle. This is in Aristotle, arche, he called it, which combines the intelligibility of nature with the intelligibility of human nature. And so he worries that human beings, Montesquieu worries that human beings will give themselves up to blind fatality, which is to have to live according to the simplicity of natural laws, physical laws, and therefore he understands human laws as different, and they're different because they're based on a reaction of human beings to what is given. So in this way, though he's a writer with much data, many data, mm-hmm. He sees that human beings are not determined by what is given to them by nature, but they react against it. And so that a principle of human action is what he calls a ressort, which means a spring. A spring is you react against something. Mm-hmm. It's not taking you in a certain direction. So all... that's in a way his principle of teaching as well. He tries to speak indirectly. He thinks that a legislator can often make a greater impression by not by going directly, passing a law directly on what he wants, but by showing. By getting an indirect effect. So, for example, he wants to make political life more equal. I think that's, in this way, more Republican, as he said. But he criticizes an ancient legislator named Phalius, who's discussed in Aristotle's Politics, who lived in Chalcedon, criticizes him for trying to make a republic more equal by passing a law that requires everyone to be equal. And he says what that doesn't, in fact, is create a civil war between the poor and the rich. So you have to find some way of finding a principle that will bring the poor and the rich together without directing them to do so. And that could be something like commerce, mm-hmm. which, or today we would say the free market,
right.
in which everyone can participate in a way equally because you have equal opportunity, even if the results are unequal. And that's a way of making our society more equal without forcing it, without trying to level them, bringing the poor up and the rich down. So that would be just one example of doing something indirectly. And also, Montesquieu wants to be less direct by opposing the notion that government should be based on fear. And that was, of course, the great principle of Thomas Hobbes, that you would consent to what was reasonable if you were properly afraid of what would happen if you didn't. And the state of nature in Hobbes was designed to put you in a frame of mind, yeah. so that you would see that what would happen, the fear you would have if there were no laws and no government. And Montesquieu wants to replace this with a sense of security or comfort. And here again, this is something quite modern, which we recognize today. And the way to give security is not so much to actually pass laws, pass criminal legislation against criminality, but as to affect the opinion that people have of security. So you want to feel secure. Maybe it doesn't matter whether you actually are secure, but we human beings need to feel that way, and that's very important to us. And so our government must mustn't put us in fear. the criminal legislation must be relaxed with much lighter punishment than in the past or in the tradition. And so there's a whole book of the spirit of the laws on punishment and how it must be more light, say, less fearful. And this goes together with a government which is constitutional rather than concentrated. So in this he follows Locke as against Hobbes, but it's a way of making your government less scary.
Right.
You know? And the separation of powers, one of the main part of the feature of the separation of powers that he praises is the independence of the judiciary. And the independence of the judiciary especially contributes to the opinion of security because it separates the punishing of people from the rest of the government. So those who govern you are not the ones who actually enforce it or punish it. That's something separate, and that's the dark side of government. Any even free government or popular government has to punish. That he agrees with, but if it's done sort of separately and legally by judges who appear to be impartial because they are separate from the rest of the government, then that's the way to make people feel, have an opinion that they are secure.
And the due process, I suppose, and procedural safeguards, that's the spirit of Montesquieu, for the citizens to
that's
feel
right.
that it's not arbitrary. That's important.
Right? Yeah. That's right. And the due process of very many different places. And so he doesn't have one view of what due process consists in. But every legal system, and there are many, has its own variety and its own eccentricities. So you must look always at circumstances. And there is one sort of model constitution, the English constitution, which he gives, but he doesn't give it in such a way as to demand that right. everyone imitate it or follow it, and in fact, he denies that, and partly because he's French, and he doesn't want to get himself in a situation where a Frenchman demands of France that it model itself on its historical enemy. Right across the channel, so that's a bit of a difficulty for him, but he has a separate view, I think, of what to do for England and what to do for France. So all this means that you must look at the whole of the world and not just European countries, but South America. Australia, China, Japan, everywhere that Europeans had traveled and there was a kind of travel literature, right. The 18th century especially, and so Montesquieu's read all that, as well as all their legal documents or whatever that might exist, that anything that could be read and that tells you about different peoples, different ways in which human beings live and govern themselves. He did his best to capture and accommodate and put in his book with its hundreds of footnotes. So it's really something. So and he's very famous too for the emphasizing the influence of climate.
Right.
And there's a whole book on that and the influence of terrain. the importance of knowing or considering population. So all these books on religion, the oddities of different religions in different places, and how they are connected. So that's what he's interested in, this, you might, to use a modern word, system, or network is another one. And so he said, in French he says, tout se tient, everything holds together, everything, but not obviously, and not under some ruling principle.
And not in some doctrinaire or dogmatic way.
That's right. Or simplistic.
Sociological point of view, you might say.
That's right. Yeah.
In the best sense.
Yeah. So our freedom consists in variety and circumstantiality. In the data, but in the eccentricity of the data, not trying to gather it all together under one thought or one principle. And so he's not a fan of founding. Hmm. And so this really distinguishes him from America or Americans. So he doesn't really, to him, a founding is really more a result of historical development. And his book ends with a description of the ancient law of France that developed into the modern monarchy, and how that very gradually changed as a result of both accidents and sort of various legislation of different kings and influences from different places, so that he could be taken as a founder of a school of 19th century political thinking called historical jurisprudence. So the principles that would be the jurisprudence of a country that have developed over time must be understood historically, and that is how they developed, how they were changed. It's from looking at this way that they were developed that you can see methods of reform, or how things might be changed, and also how the bad ways, and how not to change. This historical jurisprudence becomes a kind of lesson in practical politics, and all this is opposed to the notion of having a foundation and trying to start off with something simple,
right,
like America's Declaration of Independence, you could say.
So that sounds a little bit like Burke and even Tocqueville afterwards, right? The kind of emphasis on circumstance and historical development and skepticism about too simple an application of principle or doctrine or...
Mm-hmm.
Which I suppose, and they were both influenced by. Well, Tocqueville, I think, praises Montesquieu very highly, right?
He does.
Yes.
Yes, and so does Burke.
And Burke, too, I didn't know.
Yeah,
so they are,
Oh, yeah.
So that's sort of a strain of liberalism that feels a little bit different from
Yes.
Hobbes, Locke, you know.
But Burke gives great credit to Montesquieu, a Frenchman who told the British that of the beauties of their own constitution better than they knew themselves.
That's high praise, yeah.
That's all. That is high praise.
So he tries to, he thinks it's friendlier to liberty, not, on the one hand, not that excessive ancient pride, I suppose you'd say, hand, or maybe religious pride too, but on the other hand, not too much of the modern fear that debunks the pride, but by itself can also lead to a kind of failure to defend liberty, I suppose, or to appreciate liberty, or...
And the comforts of liberty, the consolations and the comforts, the blessings of liberty. The blessings of liberty are not obvious in the philosophy of Thomas Hobbes.
Right.
So,
So that's pretty interesting kind of liberalism that I suppose isn't as fashion. One reason maybe it's not as popular is that it's too complicated and not an ism kind of, not a doctrine.
That's right.
Not a,
it doesn't, Now, Hobbes knew what he was doing if you want to create a revolution. keep it simple.
And maybe that was a century before, maybe there's a different circumstances, you know?
Yeah, right. But Montesquieu says that that kind of revolution will lead to despotism, which
it did.
A different
kind.
You could say. Maybe not in England, just because they kept things complicated in England. And Locke helped in that.
Right.
Yes, that's right. That it's to be. That's Montesquieu, and his complication. He is difficult to appreciate, and so that he was celebrated was impressive. He makes these canny remarks, which attract one's attention. So that could be the way to lead to an appreciation or the reason why one celebrates.
That reminds me of Tocqueville, who many, many people liked and enjoy reading and appreciate particular comments of without putting it together, really, the way one should ultimately. Maybe there was some of that with Montesquieu, too.
And Burke, since you mentioned him, those are three political philosophers who are difficult to put together, and perhaps deliberately so.
Purposely so,
They don't.
Now Machiavelli also, whom you've...
Yes.
All right, now let me... It's so easy to put together.
Now let me say something about Machiavelli. And to do this, I wanted to give an analysis of just one short chapter in Book 29, Chapter 19, of The Spirit of the Laws. And let me just read it to you, if I can. So here's what... Montesquieu says, and the title of this chapter is "Of Legislators." And when you read it turns out, a weighty title, but only seven sentences long, and it turns out that only philosophers are named. And so he says, Aristotle sometimes wanted to satisfy his jealousy of Plato, sometimes his passion for Alexander. Plato was indignant at the tyranny of the people of Athens. Machiavelli was full of his idol, Duke Valentino. Thomas More, who spoke rather of what he had read than of what he had thought, wanted to govern all states with the simplicity of a Greek town. And there's a footnote, Utopia. If you didn't know that book that Thomas More had written, he tells you. Harrington saw only the Republic of England, while a crowd of writers found disorder wherever they did not see a crown. The laws always meet the passions and prejudices of the legislator. Sometimes they pass through and are tinctured. Sometimes they remain there and are incorporated.
And that's so, it. That's of legislators.
Wow. Those are the seven sentences, and that's it. And the only, so five philosophers are named. So philosophers, and it's rather shocking to see philosophers treated so cavalierly by another philosopher. And but he doesn't mind shocking you,
right?
In this instance, he is shocked by those people who are impressed by philosophers. So now he's following tradition, both ancient and modern, when he calls philosophers legislators. That philosophers can't just address other philosophers, because they need to protect themselves against people who don't like or don't understand or who disagree with what they're teaching philosophically. And this begins with Plato's Apology of Socrates, in which he gives a defense of Socrates against the charges, capital charges, which, for the sake of which he was actually punished and killed in Athens. So that's the importance of legislation for philosophers. They want to defend themselves, protect themselves against the political thoughts or the political objections to what they say and do. But another reason might be that philosophers want to learn something from politics. And you can see that it's clear in Montesquieu, since he speaks of human reaction, human resistance to nature, that non-philosophers, people who aren't philosophers, have a reaction, a resistance to being bossed around by philosophers who are more intelligent than they, but somehow remote and not very sympathetic often.
Right.
So so you can, as a philosopher, you can learn from the resistance of non-philosophers to philosophy. And that's, I think, what he's trying to teach you here. Philosophers are human beings too.
Right.
And they have passions, passions which deflect them or which give a tincture to the laws which they propose and announce. So let's look at each of these philosophers that he names. Now he starts with Aristotle. For some reason, Aristotle ahead of Plato.
Yeah, out of order.
Right? Yeah, out of order, for sure. So he says, Aristotle was jealous of Plato, and he had a passion for Alexander. Jealous of Plato, his teacher for, his revered teacher of 20 years. This is especially unfair of Montesquieu because Aristotle is very well known. One of the most famous passages in all of Aristotle is in the beginning of the Ethics, where he disagrees with Plato, but precedes his disagreement with an apology. And he says, and says very famously, saying, "I love Plato, but I love the truth more than my friend." And perhaps because the basis of friendship is truth. And so now to call him jealous of Plato seems especially unfortunate and unfair. He had a passion for Alexander. Alexander was his student, and Alexander wanted to conquer the world. I think the insinuation is that Aristotle wanted to conquer the world like his student. If you go by one of the principles of Machiavelli that we'll come to in a moment, the effectual truth of something, that the truth of a thing can be known better from what it results in, the outcome, then you could say that the truth of a philosopher is better shown in his students, so what they actually do, than what they say or intend. And so already Montesquieu has said that the real truth of Plato is to be found in Sparta, that very harsh, virtuous republic that spent its life, its common life, in warfare and in education for warfare. And now he's suggesting of Aristotle that the effectual truth of him is to be seen in his student, Alexander. He wants to conquer the world. That is, he wants to rule over the world, and that's he's a philosopher who's a legislator, and you could say this is a necessary thought that would arise from his ambition to give good advice to legislators. Later on, before this, in another chapter, Montesquieu speaks against Aristotle. He says Aristotle didn't understand monarchy. He didn't understand that the power of a monarchy could be better, more effective, and better directed if it were divided into three powers. So this suggests that Aristotle needed to learn from Montesquieu about the separation of powers. Then we go to Plato, who was indignant against the tyranny of the Athenian people. Well, he was indignant against them because they killed Socrates.
Right.
So that is probably a reasonable principle on which to inspire the indignation. Yeah. But Plato used just one person in his dialogues to represent philosophy. So Socrates was kind of the one representative of philosophy. This, Montesquieu, I think, is hinting, makes it too despotic in its effect. It suggests that philosophy is concentrated in one person, and one person alone, who's the best. So that's I think, something he wants to reprove. He himself refers to many philosophers throughout his book. He does refer just once to Socrates in a footnote, but one interesting philosopher that he never mentions, whom I've already mentioned, and who was his companion, you might say, in influencing America, he never mentions John Locke. It's very striking. His fellow liberal, it's an obvious comparison there. So Montesquieu has many philosophers. So then Machiavelli. So there are five philosophers mentioned, and Machiavelli is the third, the central figure of those who are mentioned. And he says, well, Machiavelli was full of his idol, Duke Valentino, or Valentino, idol. An idol is a image of a false god, or a false image of God.
Right.
Image of a false god. Well, if you look carefully at Machiavelli, this is in Machiavelli's Prince, he does refer to the Duke Valentino, but he mainly refers to Cesare Borgia, whom he says had another name, Duke Valentino, by a name that was given to him by the people or by the vulgar. So, and in the Prince, Cesare Borgia is the only person with two names.
Hmm.
That makes me think of Jesus, who had two names, and so that when Machiavelli says that he wants to imitate the doings and exercises of Cesare Borgia, that means, I think, that he wants to imitate the wonderful success of Christ, who was the one unarmed prophet, and most obvious unarmed prophet in Machiavelli's day, who succeeded, who came to success. Machiavelli likes to say that an unarmed prophet never succeed. But he was armed in a certain way. He had a powerful doctrine that he was able to propagate, propaganda. This was the main force and power that Christianity had. It conquered the world like Alexander, but it did so surreptitiously or subversively, not by conquering peoples and killing people or and taking over territories like Muhammad and Moses and David, but indirectly, so with propaganda. So Montesquieu, I think, sees this perfectly well when he refers to Duke Valentine instead of Cesare Borgia.
Right.
As perfectly, he sees that perfectly well and understands this. This is what Machiavelli is up to in The Prince and chapters, especially chapter 7 and later 18 in The Prince. And so this raises, I think, a more general question of the debt of Montesquieu to Machiavelli. And I think he, in the first place, learned from Machiavelli, and in the second place, disagreed with Machiavelli. What he learned from Machiavelli was the principle of effectual truth that I've already spoken of. This is occurs in the 15th chapter of Machiavelli's Prince, and he says, I want to go to the effectual truth of the thing rather than to the imagination of it. And he immediately applies this to morality, he says, and politics. He speaks against the imaginary republics and kingdoms that the ancient writers had spoken of, like Plato's Republic or St. Augustine's City of God. And he uses this phrase, verita effettuale, means effectual truth, that the truth of a thing is in its effect. And strangely, very strangely, Machiavelli uses this phrase only once in all of his writings, not just in this one book, but The Prince, but anywhere. He doesn't use it in a letter or any of his ambassadorial writings. And so it's really amazing, I think, that so important a thing would be left to this single expression. And if you look in the Italian Renaissance, I argued this elsewhere, you've seen this phrase, effectual truth, never.
Well.
And it seems that Machiavelli invented the word effectual, and especially the combination of the two, effectual truth, that it doesn't seem to have any source or previous. And so this is what Montesquieu picked up from Machiavelli, the importance of the effectual truth, of, for example, understanding philosophy through the passions of human beings, as he's doing in this chapter, and on all the way through. So the effectual truth of a thing is what it reduces to. It's a principle not only of morality but also of science, of modern science. In morality, an example would be if someone says to you, saying, I love you. The effectual truth is, I want something from you. And in science, the effectual truth is that the only real cause is the cause that produces an effect. So what Aristotle called the efficient cause. And in modern science, it speaks only of effects. Of the causes that produce effects and not formal or final causes that are for the sake of some end or purpose. So this effectual truth is sort of scientific reductionism that applies to human affairs as well. So, and that's quite striking, the way in which Machiavelli anticipates modern science and the way in which Montesquieu, who makes use of some scientific sort of understanding of the nerves and how nerves can produce an effect, instead of then that's a factual truth, effectual truth of what you think you're thinking is a thought. Thought may be just motion of your nerves. So this is what Montesquieu learned from Machiavelli, but what he disagreed with was the notion that Machiavelli had that in order to protect yourself and to understand yourself, you had to try to become dependent on no one but yourself. So the freest person is the most powerful person, then, because the most powerful person doesn't depend on other people. And if you depend on other people, it's the same thing as depending on chance, because you can't be sure how they're going to treat you, mm-hmm. or how they react to you. So for Machiavelli, the goal, you might say, of human action is to become one alone, uno solo, in Machiavelli's phrase. And in The Prince, several times he speaks of, and in the discourses too, the need for not just a politician, but anyone to put himself in a situation where he is uno solo. But uno solo is really a tyrant. Mm-hmm. A tyrant is a person who can call on anything or everything, and is dependent on nothing, or thinks he is, or tries to become that way.
Or God.
Yeah, or yeah. God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, God is by himself. So Montesquieu picks up this phrase, uno solo, and puts it in French, un seul, one alone, and he repeats that throughout the spirit of the laws in many contexts. And it's always something that produces despotism. Hmm. So it's the power of things which results in whose effectual truth is to make one person powerful. And it applies to philosophers as well as to just politicians or to ordinary folk. So you see this, I think, throughout Montesquieu, his acceptance of the effectual truth and his denial of, you might say, the effectual truth of the effectual truth, which is despotism. So Machiavelli understands the need of every human being as acquiring. You have to acquire. You can never take for granted what you inherit or what you already have. You have to acquire because other people are after you. Essentially, other people are your enemies. Even your friends will betray you or put themselves first. So you have to acquire. And he uses this sort of economic word in a political sense too. So you can acquire the world, or you can acquire the state, when you would expect the word conquer, conquistare. And so he uses it politically as well as economically. And Montesquieu replaces that with commerce. Commerce is the spirit of acquisition, but made moderate in such a way as to prevent despotism. So commerce is, as has been said, bloodless killing. But it's also without despotic concentration of power, and at the same time it makes you richer and more powerful in the things that riches can give you. So that's Machiavelli, and now Thomas More, the fourth legislator, who spoke of what he read and not what he thought, and who wanted to govern all states with the simplicity of a Greek town, then that was utopia, that Greek, by which More meant Plato's Republic. Right. Yeah, his Utopia was a kind of redoing of the Plato's Republic, which is, again, the oneness of, that is, a philosopher who was also king. This simplicity is in general bad, the simplicity of a Greek town, because it leads to the mastery of one, and to the he leaves out the fact that, or he says Thomas More spoke of what he read rather than he thought. So which did he read? Did he read Plato's Republic, or did he read the other thing that he might have read, namely the Bible?
Right.
And then Thomas More is famous for being Sir Thomas More and Saint Thomas More, as a Christian martyr in his time, only recently after Montesquieu made a saint. So so he was one person, but which was he? Mm-hmm. See, a philosopher politician, then, or a martyr for God. So, and then last, we've got Harrington and this crowd of royalists. And so now Harrington wrote a book called Oceana, which was an imaginary England. And so he focused entirely on England. And Harrington is mentioned one other place in Montesquieu's book, and criticized, that he said built Chalcedon, that was a famous city in Asia Minor, right on the coast, with the coast of in the view of the coast of Byzantium. So Byzantium is really England. This is what Montesquieu says at the end of his chapter praising the English Constitution and Harrington's attempt to improve on it. Mm-hmm. So Byzantium is really England, said, and he tried to build something else to be more beautiful, but and next to this beautiful city.
Right.
So he tried to make an improvement on something that was much better than his imitation. So this is what his view of Harrington and what he did was to make England totally Republican, and with no monarchy, no monarch, no one again. See? Then the royalist writers, they wanted a crown, but they didn't care about the rest, the Republican side of things. And so Montesquieu, so once again, that's the question of one, that in each of these cases, the philosopher makes his mistake by not understanding the dangers from the rule and the thought of one. And Montesquieu now brings up the need to have a kind of one in a republic. An executive, a powerful monarch, who's an executive. So we have a strong president in American Constitution, but at the same time, in company with republican features, popular features, so that it was not just a monarchy that royalist writers might approve of or might require. So this is Montesquieu. He's effectual truth, but opposed to the concentration of power in one. He himself is, you could say, therefore, a kind of embarrassed or prudent, inconspicuous philosopher who wants to stay behind the scenes and not present himself in such a way that he is not just celebrated, but worshipped or followed without hesitation. So I think he's not a revolutionary, but he would be happy to be celebrated.
And he's entitled to be unfair to these philosophers because he, I would believe you could say he is in these little dismissive judgments, psychologizing judgments about them because he wants to keep philosophy and philosophers in their place, I suppose.
That's right, in their place, yeah. And they have a place. And then, because after all, he only mentions the philosophers.
Right.
He doesn't contrast them with others that he might have brought up, like Solon.
Yeah,
you expect
if you see something called of legislators, doesn't one sort of expect Solon or something like that?
Yeah, someone of that caliber.
Or even a modern legislator. Or, mm-hmm. That's interesting. Am I wrong to think that the thing about Aristotle not appreciating that monarchy would be more powerful mm-hmm. than three parts, that somehow sounds like a Christian, also a comment on
exactly
the Christian use of Aristotle.
Yes, that was very perceptive of you. Yes,
I don't think it was that perceptive, kind of obvious, but anyway. So that's somehow.
Yeah, Aristotle didn't understand that he could be misinterpreted support the Christian way of thinking,
which is a more powerful monarch, so to speak.
But
that somehow is underlying this too. Some discussion.
It is.
Christianity and religion, I suppose, and its need to be
kept in its place.
And
that way, he was still with the early moderns too, who had the same desire to bring Christianity to heal, to make it listen to the requirements of reason and peace.
And does he, I just don't even know, does he discuss Machiavelli explicitly elsewhere, or is this, he uses Husserl in ways that I'm sure you've...
There is another chapter in which he discusses both Aristotle and Machiavelli. And he makes this remark about Machiavelli, we are beginning to be cured of Machiavellism.
Oh.
And so that's, that I think is, that contains both the idea of effectual truth, because Machiavelli is now turned into Machiavellism, which, in other words, a kind of cynical, dirty trick politics, and the idea of opposing one alone, because what he said Machiavellism was in this case was the use of great strokes of authority, sensational executions, which are a feature of Machiavelli's political science. So we're replacing the great strokes of authority, sensational, revolutionary, impressive appearances that will rule people and make them fear by commerce, gradual change, constitutionalism,
separation
of powers, altogether goodbye to Machiavelli in his bitterest and strangest and most tyrannical moments. So, and you could criticize Montesquieu from this standpoint, I think, that reading this, you wouldn't expect that human beings were capable of the terrible things, the terrible events of the 20th century.
Though beginning to be cured sounds like you can't maybe be fully cured. I mean,
that's
there's always an element of Machiavelli, so to
speak.
And of
conditionality. It's not definite.
Right.
But he thinks we're on the road to what Nietzsche called the last man.
Softening.
To security and freedom. and moderate freedom.
Yeah, that's interesting. Final words on Montesquieu for people. This has hopefully encouraged people to take a fresh look and appreciate both the spirit of the laws and the other two works too, which are both, those two I'd say, having read them decades ago, but I mean, yeah, are fun, are easy, they're not really easier, I'm sure, but seems to be easier.
That's true.
To read, and are fun reads, really, in a way, right? The Persian Letters is,
yeah,
like not just novelistic, I guess it is actually a novel. And yeah, the Grandeur and Decline of the Romans is a kind of apparently breezy kind of,
yeah,
walk through Roman history kind of.
Yes. I would say Montesquieu is wonderfully French and wonderfully cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
He has something to teach us all.
So we should follow the founders and studying, yeah, him.
Not just celebrate him, but see why it is that he should be celebrated by reading his books.
Yeah, I think they say justly celebrated somewhere, right?
So yes.
So
reasonably.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's good. Well, this has been great, and I'm sure many people will benefit from this and really go read Montesquieu where they haven't before, or read him more carefully, certainly, than they have before. So thank you for teaching us about Montesquieu.
You're welcome, but it's a pleasure always.
Thank you, Harvey Mansfield, for joining me today, and thank you for joining us on Conversations.